This is Michael Reinhart, welcoming you to the U.S. National Privacy and Cybersecurity Podcast. We are led by our two hosts, Jerry Buckley and Jody Westby. This podcast is sponsored by the Association for Data and Cyber Governance. The association offers a 50% discount on membership to our podcast listeners when they go to www.adcg.org and use code POD. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and please feel free to leave us a rating or comment.
This is Jody Westby, and I'm here with my co-host, Jerry Buckley. We are excited to have John Reed Stark as our guest today. John is president of John Reed Stark Consulting, a data breach response and digital compliance firm. Formerly, he served for almost 20 years in the enforcement division of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, the last 11 of which as chief of its Office of Internet Enforcement. John currently teaches a cyber law course as a senior lecturing fellow at Duke University Law School. He also served as managing director of the global forensic firm Stroh Friedberg and is the author of the Cybersecurity Due Diligence Handbook. Although we've spent a fair amount of time discussing various aspects regarding the FTC's role in privacy and cybersecurity enforcement, we haven't had anyone on our series yet to discuss SEC cybersecurity actions. And your perspective is always widely sought and listened to on these matters. So again, we're just so happy to have you. Let's start by providing our listeners with a bit of background on the SEC's role and the guidance it issued in 2011 and 2018 by the SEC's Corporation Finance Division. Can you provide some background on that guidance?
Sure thing, Jody. It's great to be here with you, a legend in the cybersecurity business, and Jerry Buckley, and also a legend both in the law, cyber, and consumer protection business. It's really a privilege to be a part of this podcast, and can't wait to get started here. So let's look at how the SEC regulates cyber. What is their role? Because you brought that up in your intro. And it's really kind of twofold. On the one hand, there are public companies out there, and public companies have to disclose when a cyber incident, they have to disclose anything that's material to their shareholders. And they have to disclose that accurately, and it has to be truthful, and it has to be candid. And they also have to make disclosures in their quarterly filings and their annual filings with the SEC concerning cybersecurity, because that's important information that investors need to know. So that's the one hand, public companies. Then there's the SEC's role in regulating financial firms, SEC registered firms like broker dealers, investment advisors, investment companies, and others. And in that role, the SEC has a much, much broader mandate, which is to make sure that the cybersecurity at those firms is reasonable under the safeguards rule, to make sure that that information is protected. So those are sort of the two categories. And your question relates to the first category, which is the disclosures of information to shareholders by companies that pertains to cyber. And the 2011 guidance that the SEC put out was really kind of a shot across the bow in this regard. And it really put every public company on notice that cyber attacks and cybersecurity vulnerabilities fell squarely within a public company's reporting responsibilities. That anything that was material relating to cyber needed to be disclosed. What is material? Well, that, of course, is a question that has plagued lawyers forever. It's both quantitative and qualitative in its analysis. But you might disclose, where do you disclose that information per the 2011 guidance? Also, I should say, the 2011 guidance didn't announce that this was now necessary. It was really kind of restating what the SEC had been saying was necessary all along with respect to cybersecurity vulnerabilities and attacks and disclosure of those things, but just kind of put it out there in this corporation finance guidance. The SEC does this all the time. They do, you know, guidance statements. They say things in speeches, no action letters. There's all sorts of regulatory pronouncements that don't come from Congress and don't come from judges, but come from the SEC itself. And this is one of them. And I think that when the SEC looked at this, they wanted to remind companies that these cybersecurity disclosures might be part of the risk factors disclosures, the MD&A, management discussion and analysis of financial condition and results of operations, description of business, legal proceedings, financial statement disclosures, disclosure controls and procedures, all those different categories of information that are on 10Qs and 10Ks and other SEC filings might also be required to have cyber filings. So that's the 2011 guidance. The 2018 guidance was really a follow-up. A lot of people complain that the 2011 guidance was vague or wasn't specific and didn't give enough information for companies to make these kinds of decisions. So the 2018 kind of followed up and stressed the need for public companies to put into practice disclosure controls and procedures designed to escalate cybersecurity risks and incidents to the right C-suite executives. So there, the SEC was not only commenting on the disclosures, but the internal controls relating to cyber. And they emphasized the urgency for public companies to make appropriate disclosures to investors with cybersecurity, which was really nothing new. And they also articulated the SEC's growing concerns about unlawful trading involving data security incidents, meaning that there were senior executives who would learn about an incident and then maybe dump their shares of stock because they were concerned that when the incident became public, the stock price would go down. So I think the most critical aspect of the 2018 guidance was the reminder that public companies have to maintain robust disclosure controls and procedures designed to analyze or assess data security incidents for potential disclosure in the company filings. And really that means that these kind of, the SEC is saying is that, look, if you don't have good internal controls with respect to cyber, then as a consequence, your financial statements and your other public statements about your company are not going to be adequate because they don't properly incorporate what's going on in your company as a result of cyber. So that was a very long answer, Jody, but that's essentially what those two pieces of guidance said.
Oh, that's a terrific summary. And, you know, but in my head, there's two things that stand out for me in the SEC guidance. One is helping companies understand that what is material, what's a material breach. There was a lot of interpretation going on among general counsels about, well, was this breach really material? And then the second, which the 2018 guidance, I call the Equifax guidance, was about insider trading, you know, executives trading shares right after an event before it became publicly disclosed. So I think that they've actually helped the marketplace a lot with these two pieces of guidance. And I think they've been very effective. I think they've done a good job. But let me turn this over to Jerry. Jerry, please.
Thank you. And John, let me join Jody in thanking you for being with us today and for your kind remark about us. In fact, you are a legend yourself, and we really appreciate your excellent background on the SEC guidance. In 2018, the SEC brought an action against Yahoo for failing to disclose a 2014 breach until 2016. After a three-year hiatus between 2018 and 2021, the SEC recently brought separate actions against the global publishing company Pearson PLC and against First American Financial Corporation. Can you tell us about these three actions and how the 2011 and 2018 guidance fit into the SEC's actions?
Sure, absolutely. And it's kind of interesting because in the last 2 weeks, it's typical of you both to be on top of something that's so new and so timely because you're absolutely right. There hadn't been much action in that first category of public disclosures of cyber information by public companies. But there suddenly was with this Pearson and First American cases. And then about a week or so after that, the SEC filed a series of cases against Cetera, Cambridge, and KMS, which I think we're going to talk about a little later, which were SEC-regulated entities that had cybersecurity failures. So, and there had been maybe 9 or 10 cases prior to that, but I think the last one was 2017 or 2018. So this definitely tells us something, that first and foremost, there's a new sheriff in town. The new SEC chairman has clearly announced that these are going to be priorities. And has given that actions speak louder than words, certainly when it comes to the SEC, these cases say a lot. So let's talk about this first wave of cases that you ask about, Pearson and First American. Pearson involved the theft of student data and administrative login credentials of 13,000 school, district, and university customer accounts. First American involved their what they're was called their Eagle Pro application, and had shared document images related to title and escrow transactions, and had a vulnerability that exposed over 800 million title and escrow documents images dating back to 2003. Those are what the SEC alleges. These were settled administrative proceedings. Yet another way that the SEC make regulatory pronouncements, you know, they can draft these settled orders and put in whatever they want, whatever they can get the opposing counsel to agree on, and then the secretary of the SEC can sign off on it. So what are the important lessons of these cases? First of all, of course, the need for timely and accurate disclosures relating to cyber. Second of all, this one is really crazy, Jerry, and I'm sure you would appreciate policing the boilerplate, because in one of these cases, the boilerplate in buried deep within the public filings was the idea that the company may have experienced a data breach, but the SEC alleged that it had experienced a data breach. Or a cyber attack. So given that they forgot to use have instead of may, they got hit with an SEC action. So you got to police all that boilerplate and make sure it's accurate. You got to think twice about secrecy. When hit by a cyber attack, you got to lead with transparency, candor, honesty. Pearson's top brass, I think they sort of kept deciding that there was no need to disclose the data security incident. While First American CISO and CIO failed to inform the company's senior executives of their prior knowledge of the vulnerability. And in the end, both companies kind of shot themselves in the foot. There are really some amazing things about these cases that stand out to me. I agree with you, Jody, that the 2011 and 2018 guidance was an excellent source for companies and went about as far as the SEC could, because they can't prescribe specific types of cybersecurity. If they do that, first of all, they're setting an artificial threshold and probably giving a safe harbor when it might not be appropriate. And secondly, that technology overnight can be rendered ineffective. So the best they can do is say, you know, hey, you've got to make these kinds of disclosures, and here's when we think you should. But, you know, one last point that doesn't get lost in the translation of these cases, that in both of these cases, even if the company's cyber-related internal reporting was a mistake, you know, nobody was lying about this, the SEC will still charge you. Even if it's not material, when it comes to internal reporting, it doesn't matter. A failure in internal reporting has nothing to do with materiality. And even if the case doesn't involve a hint of fraud and doesn't even cause any data security incident, the SEC is still going to sue you. So, you know, the sad reality is that whenever a company experiences a cyber attack, they'll need to gather their battle gear for a potential attack from the SEC. It's very challenging, I think, to make these decisions as to when something needs to be disclosed and to make sure you're always being accurate. And I think companies are doing the best that they can. So this is an area where I think the SEC is being very, very aggressive. And I'm sure you're spending a lot of time advising clients how to handle this.
You know, John, there is this tension between disclosure and exposure of vulnerabilities. When you think about it, really, if I'm a shareholder, I would like to know whether the company has significant vulnerabilities in this space. If I am a potential attacker, I also want to know that. And so the tension between letting your investors know what being candid about the company's situation and what its vulnerabilities are, and the need to protect the company from not exposing its vulnerabilities to potential cyber criminals, is an interesting challenge. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, that's a great point, because I think here is where the 2011 and 2018 guidance really just falls short. Because on the one hand, the guidance says, look, if you're going to make a disclosure about cybersecurity in any way, shape, or form, we don't want it to be boilerplate. We want it to be meaningful, substantive, carefully drafted. But on the other hand, both guidance talk about, they appreciate the fact that you can't disclose much about a data breach, because then you're giving a roadmap to an attacker. So managing that balance is something that the guidance doesn't give you. So I think the safest bet is to say, you know, under any circumstance, the safest bet is almost to say, here's what we've found so far things could change so easily. We have engaged the top experts who are entirely independent to look at this situation and give us advice. And we will keep reporting as these things develop. But expect change, because on Monday we might believe Alpha and on Friday we might believe Omega. That's simply the way it works when it comes to data security breach investigations.
Yeah, that's really right. You know, with the forensic investigations, it is like peeling an onion and people want answers right away. They need to understand that there's many layers to those investigations. So, John, the SEC has also been very focused on investment advisory firms the past several years. So let's also start with some information for our listeners on the SEC Regulation SP, its safeguards rule under GLBA, Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. What are the basics of Reg SP and the SEC guidance and the inspections that it's been conducting on investment advisory firms over the last several years?
Sure. You know, this is, again, a very sort of vague and subjective, but really the best we can do, I think, in terms of our expectations of the SEC. And the safeguards rule, you know, essentially says that you've got to have reasonable cybersecurity if you're a financial firm. And when I say financial firm, I mean an SEC registered entity like an investment advisor, an investment company, or a broker dealer, that you've got to have reasonable cybersecurity. And if you don't, if we think you don't, meaning we, the SEC, if the SEC thinks you don't have good cybersecurity, they can charge you. And they send out specific the Office of Compliance, they call it the Division of Examinations now, it was formerly the Office of Compliance, Inspections, and Examinations. They can do for cause examinations, they can do routine examinations, and they now have a fairly robust group of examiners who will come in and expect to see all kinds of documentation about cyber incidents and will review that. And they've also reached out, the examination staff is working closely with the enforcement staff with respect to the SolarWinds hack. They've reached out to every company and said that they can think of, and maybe even some they couldn't think of, to say, hey, we'd like to know how you disclosed the potential impact of the SolarWinds hack upon your company. And they're looking for failures. Now, to me, again, the SEC is being very aggressive here, and I'm not sure I agree. I mean, imagine, you know, your new car gets stolen from your driveway and you call the police, and then they end up citing you because you didn't properly install the new app or you messed up the settings on that app that would have automatically locked the doors of the car or warned you of a tamper or warned you that somebody had started it up. Or imagine if your house is broken into and you call the police and the police start investigating, but they also cite you because your alarm system was out of date or you didn't turn it on or it wasn't patched properly. You know, cybersecurity is an oxymoron. Their data breaches are inevitable. Yeah. Legions of soldiers wake up every morning with the sole intention of hacking into U.S. systems. So again, these recent cases, the ones I mentioned before that have to do where the SEC is bringing away Cetera, Cambridge, and KMS, they all involve account intrusions. They all involve violations of the SEC safeguards rule. And, you know, with respect to all of them, the SEC has, I think, been fairly relentless. You know, in each instance, the company was sort of learned that multi-factor authentication should be something that they put in place.
Let's give a little bit more background on those, because that just happened recently when they charged 8 separate SEC registered broker dealers and investment advisory firms. Some of those were affiliated, so that's why you're naming only 3 companies, the Cetera, Cambridge, and KMS. But altogether, there were 8 companies. So what happened? Give our listeners a little bit about what happened that caused this flurry of activity. Because for them to come out all of a sudden and do, wham, bang, 8 companies and bring these actions, that's pretty unusual.
Oh, definitely. You're absolutely right. And it's really just a harbinger of what's to come, because these cases they're like shooting fish in a barrel, Jody. And once again, these 3 cases without alleging fraud, without charging any individuals, and this time, without alleging harm to any customer or other stakeholder, the SEC filed these 3, again, administrative actions in their home court, all settled, all relating to the failure of SEC registered entities to safeguard customer information. And all three matters involve these account intrusions. Cetera involved the cloud-based email accounts of over 60 Cetera entities. Personnel were taken over by unauthorized third parties, resulting in the exposure of personally identified information, PII, of at least 4,388 customers and clients. These are the SEC's allegations. And that case involved misleading breach notification language, where the firm sent out notification letters about the breach, but they said that it had happened recently when it actually they had known about it maybe 4 or 5 months earlier. Cambridge involved the cloud-based email accounts of over 121 Cambridge representatives, which had been taken over by unauthorized third parties, resulting in the PII exposure of at least 2,177 Cambridge customers. And there again, the failure to adopt multi-factor authentication after that kind of exposure, the SEC chided Cambridge for. And then KMS involved the cloud-based email accounts of 15 KMS financial advisors or their assistants. They were taken over by unauthorized third parties, resulting in the PII exposure of approximately 4,900 KMS customers and clients. And there, that was more of a failure to adopt written policies and procedures regarding cybersecurity failures. So the SEC wants you to have reasonable cybersecurity, and they also want you to have reasonable procedures so that senior executives are made aware of everything. And Jody, this is very tough. If you're a big financial firm, you're going to get all kinds of alerts and all kinds of incidents every single day. And if you start feeling like I've got to report these up the chain every single time, management is going to have to create a specific channel for that because of the amount of drag that those kinds of communications can result in. So do you want me to talk about the lessons from these cases or did you have some specific questions?
I want to throw that to Jerry.
Okay.
You know, it's really interesting that these are, you know, extremely important to financial services firms. Your recent article, Key Takeaways from the Second Summer Blitzkrieg of the SEC's Cybersecurity Enforcement, does lay out some very interesting takeaways from these cases. And maybe you'd be willing to share those with us.
Sure. I'll highlight some of them. You know, first of all, and Jerry, I'm sure you've dealt with this, the meticulous breach notification. So you've got to be really careful about anything that you send out as a notification. It should not be a marketing document or a PR mechanism. It needs to be a real legal document that lots of people look at before it goes out to make sure it's accurate. And, you know, I think companies have a desire, and I don't blame them, to sort of spin these as it's not the end of the world because cyber attacks happen every day. And remember, you rarely find out who the attacker is. You rarely find out who the ultimate victim is, meaning the nexus between if an account was account information or PII was somehow exfiltrated. Did anyone actually use that to commit identity theft and victimize someone? That sort of fact rarely happens. So no one's ever apprehended. No victim, ultimate victim is ever identified. And the SEC is still going to be on you. So I think, you know, what Jody said at the beginning, the safeguards rule of Reg SP is the hook. And it kind of reminds me, Jerry, of like the books and records rule, which is the internal controls hook for financial reporting cases. When I worked at the SEC, anytime you brought a financial reporting case, there was always a failure of books and records. The same goes for safeguards rule. I think the independent thing that you mentioned, Jody, is important to understand. I've had a lot of clients over the years, and Jerry, I'm sure you have as well, where you have sort of the mothership and then you have these independent affiliates who kind of throw out a shingle. And the independent model is a big deal to these operators. And I think there's always been some confusion about cyber, meaning if the mothership says you have to do the following 10 things with respect to your cyber, and the independent operator just doesn't have the funds for that, who's responsible? So I think this case makes it clearer, these cases, that everyone is responsible when there's a failure.
Very interesting point. Very interesting point. And this is part of the challenge that people face is how do they have enough knowledge to deal with these issues? And I do want to interject that Jody has developed a tremendous course for data privacy and protection specialists that I would advise anybody to consider taking. It's not long. It's a certificate course, and it really does give people out in the field the opportunity to understand what the total responsibilities are, and they don't right now.
No, I was going to go back to Jody also, because Jody, one of the things that the KMS case, they didn't have sort of a bespoke incident response plan. From what I could tell from the pleadings, it's not actually clear from the order. It seems though they might have had more of a boilerplate plan, and the plan wasn't specific enough to KMS. My guess is you see that a lot, and you probably have to deal with it. And it isn't something, part of what you do is to develop a customized plan. And that the SEC says that everybody's got to do that.
Right. They often don't decide to do it though until they really get in trouble. Even after companies have had a breach and they've been flying by the seat of their pants and it's been crazy. Once it's all kind of over, everyone just says, oh, thank God. And then they all just turn their head and go back to whatever they were focusing on before. And maybe then they'll decide, well, we really should put together a plan so we don't have to do this in such a wild manner the next time. But it's just, I don't know what it's going to take for companies to spend the money and do what they need to do to have proper backups, to have encryption of data, to have incident response plans, to actually be prepared. Because it's just so hard to watch companies go through this and then afterward not do the things they need to do. But,
you know, I feel like it starts at the board level. You know, I feel that the boards should really figure out ways to specialize in cyber and treat cyber kind of like the same way they would financial reporting. Yeah. Have quarterly risk and security assessments that report up to an audit committee, have a separate data security committee or an audit committee that at least specifically entails that, and have expertise on the board with cyber. So just like the way boards have developed in the way that they approach financial reporting responsibilities, they should do the same for cyber. And you know, what's so amazing about these cases, both the offering cases that I mentioned initially, the First American and Pearson, et cetera, Cambridge and KMS, none of these cases require any level of scienter. In fact, individuals aren't even charged. So, you know, with the safeguards rule, good faith is not a defense. Willfully, for purposes of imposing relief under the safeguards rule, means no more than that the person charged with the duty knows what he or she is doing. There is no requirement that the person also be aware that they're violating the law. So it's, you know, willful as to the act, not to the violation. And that makes it very difficult to defend. And victims, as I said, are presumed and not required. So you've really got to do everything you can on the infrastructure side, which means everything from patching and passwords and the whole list of things that you really need to be careful and meticulous about on the cyber. But you've also got to control, monitor, and limit employee and administrative access to data. No matter what, there are going to be breaches. There are going to be attacks. So you've got to do the best you can. You got to respond with speed, with transparency, with independency, with vigor. And some firms might escape SEC enforcement, but others might get penalized regardless. You know, to me, when a data security incident occurs at an SEC registered financial firm, whether that firm gets sued by the SEC enforcement division, it almost seems, for lack of a better word, a bit of a crapshoot. Do you really know what is there some trigger that means the SEC is going to get to go after you? I think what you mentioned early on and what we've talked about is trying to be responsible, not being secretive. You know, you can even get kicked when you're down, because in some instances, in one of these cases, a forensic firm had given a recommendation of that the firm implement multi-factor authentication. And as a result, the SEC looked at that recommendation, noticed that the firm didn't do it quickly enough, and ironically sued the firm. So you've got to be careful with these reports when you hire someone. They can give you a laundry list, though I would be very careful about that. But you've got to properly modulate that and make sure that these are the kinds of recommendations that you can meet. Otherwise, they're going to come back to bite you in the form of a roadmap. Because, you know, and I've seen that when I've done on the, both when I was at the SEC and during my time in the private sector, is that these heat maps and laundry lists can sometimes really come back to bite you. Other times they can be incredibly effective, but you need to be careful.
Yeah, well, especially you have to be careful with the prioritization of what you're doing so that you're doing the most important things first. But, you know, we're running out of time. I want to just throw out a thought and give this back to Jerry to close. But What we hope we can do with our podcast series is to influence legislators and policymakers in these areas. And what you just talked about with the SEC leading companies really sort of to wonder if they're the next whack-a-mole that's going to get hit. Do you have any advice for policymakers or legislators about how to provide more certainty about what companies should do?
You know, that's a tough question because, again, if you look at multi-factor authentication, all of these Cetera, Cambridge, and KMS cases talk about that. And the SEC, of course, has never specifically prescribed that because, again, they would be creating a baseline that can cause problems. So it's difficult to get there. I think what I look for in government is a real paradigm shift, and I'm not seeing it yet. I remember in the Equifax breach, which seems like history, but I remember Senator Schumer saying that the Equifax breach represented the greatest board of directors failure since Enron. And I just thought, and I'm not being at all political here, I just thought that was so incredibly unfair. Enron represented this awful fraud where investor money was stolen, lost, and thievery and chicanery, all sorts of terrible corporate and individual behavior. Typically, with respect to a data breach or a cyber attack, there's nothing like that of the sort. And these cases prove that because no individual was named in any of them. So I wish the government would look towards the things, Jody, that you and I look for, which is it's really a matter of focusing on the response. You're never going to be able to stop the cyber attack from happening. You just need to, again, respond with the speed, the transparency, independency, and vigor that I mentioned, and hope that by being that responsible and documenting it all and not being secretive, not shooting yourself in the foot, that things will go your way and the SEC will be reasonable. But remember, in this case, the SEC is, with its own administrative form, is a prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner. So you're facing a tough battle.
Yeah. Well, thanks again.
John, it's been a great session, and thank you. There's so much more to explore and so much more for the agency to think about. And I think you've given both the agency and players in the private sector a lot to think about in your presentation today. You know, a last observation, you know, if every time there was a crime committed, we fired the chief of police, we wouldn't have very many police chiefs around. And I think we've got to find a way to another way. And the SEC has got to move forward to find a way that doesn't, as you say, punish the person who didn't have the alarm system properly set on their car. On the other hand, encourages the proper controls to be in place. It's a tough challenge. But thank you so much for your joining us today, and we look forward to further discussion.
You're quite welcome. Thank you both for having me on. It's been great. I really look forward to listening to your podcast every week, whenever you're covering anything, because a lot of these areas I don't follow as closely as the SEC and IR. So I like this sort of broad approach that you guys do, covering so many important issues. So thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on U.S. National Privacy Legislation. Make sure to visit our website, adcg.org, where you can subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Cast, or via RSS, so you'll never miss an episode. While you're at it, if you found value in what you heard today, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the podcast, that would help us out too. Also, you might want to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, Data and Cyber Governance Alert, which you can do right on our homepage. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode, where we dig deeper into the possibilities of U.S. national privacy legislation.